And welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. I'm going to give you a rundown of what you're going to be hearing on the prepared portion of tonight's broadcast. First of all, we're going to take a look at something that I'm sure many of the listeners have heard about, a surprising electoral result from West Berlin, and we're going to ruminate about the parliamentary gains or the electoral gains by a formerly splinter and at least nominally insignificant right-wing party headed by a former SS man. This party has now scored what were described as alarming electoral gains in the West German elections. We're going to take a look at that and compare some of the similarities between the social climate in West Berlin and elsewhere in Western Europe and the United States, and see what ruminate about what that may hold for the future. We're also going to take a look at the NAACP's request for a federal probe of Ku Klux Klan influence at the Los Angeles Central Jail. Then we're going to take a journey into a book which we've used in a number of our archive shows in the past, an excellent book by former FBI agent turned author and private investigator William W. Turner. This book is called Power on the Right, and we're going to take a look explicitly at Ku Klux Klan and ultra-right-wing and paramilitary recruiting within police departments. We're going to take a look at a bit of its history and some of its implications. Following that, we're going to take a musical break. Then we're going to come back and take a look at a fascinating new literary development in which author Charles Higham, the author of Errol Flynn, The Untold Story, Trading with the Enemy and American Swastika, all three volumes that we have used in the past on this broadcast. He's now written a book about Cary Grant, saying that, among other things, Cary Grant worked for British intelligence, among other things, keeping an eye on Errol Flynn. Also, according to another book about Cary Grant, there are two of them coming out. He was tied up romantically with none other than Vicky Morgan at the same time as she was tied up with Alfred Bloomingdale, a member of Reagan's kitchen cabinet, a longtime friend, and a member of his, for our purposes most importantly, a member of his Foreign Intelligence Review Board. And we're going to take a look at Messrs. Flynn, Reagan, Cary Grant et al., talk a little bit about Vicky Morgan, and then we're going to take a look at Ronald Reagan's own background in the murky world of intelligence, specifically his role as an FBI informant beginning in World War II. We're also going to take a look at the espionage role of Errol Flynn on behalf of the Third Reich, and we're also going to speculate about the possible extent of Ronald Reagan's association with elements of the Third Reich, Third Reich intelligence agents, past and present. A large section of that discussion will come from tape, specifically from a One Step Beyond show from September 8th of 1985. Then we're going to take another musical break, and we're going to take a look at a number of interesting developments taking place with regard to foreign policy, among other things. We're going to take a look, first of all, at a plot by a couple of members, a couple of alleged organized crime figures with connections to the Pizza Connection case, and their plot to kill Rudolph Giuliani, the outgoing federal attorney in New York. We're also going to take a look at a recent legal decision further setting back the fortunes of the Christic Institute and their lawsuit against some defendants in the Iran-Contra scandal. We're going to review an article which was sent in by a listener and which was covered in the phone-in session a couple of weeks ago, namely an alarming article about Pan Am Flight 103, which was downed in Lockerbie, Scotland on December 21st of 1988. This discusses some unchecked baggage, specifically some U.S. military mail, which was on that flight. We're going to take a look at that article and speculate a bit about some of the significance of that particular piece of information. We're going to take a look at some information also surfacing concerning a Japanese Red Army terrorist allegedly working for Muammar Gaddafi. And, of course, Gaddafi has a lot of murky connections. A lot of those connections run straight to the United States. And we're going to take a look at this particular individual and some of his alleged connections and why this information is coming out at this time, in my opinion. We're going to then take yet another musical break, and we will take a look very briefly at the military coup, which has just taken place in Paraguay, and also take a look briefly at a number of other articles. We're not going to read them, just discuss them, and annotate them. A number of other articles pertaining to U.S. foreign policy, some key appointments, some doings, some, I think, destabilizations that either are going on or are about to be going on. That's what's coming up. Stay tuned. A little bit more Coltrane, and then back to the prepared portion of One Step Beyond. Welcome back to One Step Beyond. First article comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, January 31st of 1989. This is an AP story out of Berlin, headlined in the Chronicle, "Party led by ex-Nazi scores big win in Berlin." Dateline, Berlin. A tiny ultra-right party led by a former Nazi SS soldier has scored a surprising legislative election victory in West Berlin. The conservative Republican Party captured 11 of the West Berlin legislature's 138 seats in Sunday's balloting. It also will have 2 seats in the federal parliament in Bonn after next year's national elections, giving the ultra-right its first representation in parliament since 1953. Police said more than 10,000 people demonstrated in downtown West Berlin late yesterday to protest the Republicans' showing. There were isolated rock-throwing incidents and vandalism, but there was no violence or arrests. The Republicans, guided by former Nazi SS soldier Franz Schoenhuber, S-C-H-O-E-N-H-U-B-E-R, campaigned on a platform of ridding West Berlin of foreign workers such as Turks and of giving preferential treatment to Germans seeking jobs. That last sentence again. The Republicans, guided by former Nazi SS soldier Franz Schoenhuber, campaigned on a platform of ridding West Berlin of foreign workers, such as Turks, and of giving preferential treatment to Germans seeking jobs. Foreigners make up more than 10% of the city's population of 2.1 million people. West Germany also has been the destination of many asylum seekers from the Third World, and the Republicans called for sharp limits on their numbers. Sunday's balloting marked the first time the Republican Party, formed in 1983, has won elective seats at the state level. Schoenhuber, whose party headquarters are in Munich, did not run. The left-leaning Frankfurter Rundschau newspaper called the victories frightening, unquote. West German Jewish leader Heinz Galinsky said they are a, quote, heavy defeat for democracy, unquote. Chancellor Helmut Kohl said his governing Christian Democrats would have to, quote, take care of conservative voters, unquote, who defected. He told reporters in Bonn that the party's showing is worrisome and indicates that West Germans are increasingly concerned about the growing number of foreigners competing for jobs, housing, and social services. There is an urgent need to discuss these problems and come up with better solutions, Kohl said. A couple of things to think about in connection with this article. First of all, the situation in the United States is similar in some respects to the situation in West Germany and in West Berlin in particular, in that there are a lot of foreign workers on the one hand and a lot of foreign capital on the other. Both are moving into the United States. Workers at all levels coming from both Asia and, in particular, at some of the lower socioeconomic levels from Latin America are forming an increasingly large percentage not only of the American workforce, but also of the American population. Nowhere is that more the case than here in California, where, by all census projections, the year 2000 will see white people being in a minority in the population of California, according to population increase figures that have been projected so far. Again, between Latinos, between the Asians immigrating from a number of different countries, we are going to be having, well, basically, white people will be in a minority in California by the year 2000. In general, throughout the United States, American people and American workers in particular are being squeezed simply as a matter of fact by foreign competition, both competition overseas and increasingly competition from people moving to the United States, as I said, primarily from Asia and Latin America. And this is creating competition both in the international marketplace with regard to production and marketing, and also in the domestic marketplace with regard to employment that previously Americans had not experienced. One of the things that I've been speaking about in the last couple of weeks is my fear that the social dislocation caused by an economic collapse in this country which I think has to be viewed as at least a possibility with the enormous debt that has been piled up by this society in so many different respects, it is my fear that the social dislocation that would stem from a major economic collapse, and I think that's a possibility, and I'm not alone in that opinion, could very easily push a significant and adequate number of American people off the deep end, so to speak. I think the sense of xenophobia that a lot of Americans have been feeling, and in particular will feel after a serious economic collapse, towards the increased economic competition overseas from, say, the four tigers of Asia, or five, I've forgotten what it is. The European Economic Community is providing increased competition for the United States. We're now a debtor nation for the first time since the end of World War I, according to, thanks to Ronald Reagan and his budget deficits. And in general, America's position in the world has changed fundamentally, and that is going to have very far-reaching effects on the composition of American society. And it is my fear that there may be, and I'm afraid there are some signs, that the national security establishment in this country will deliberately scapegoat one or more minorities in order to channel the public anger that may result from an economic collapse. The German scapegoating of the Jews in the Third Reich was well recognized by many members of Amt 4B, the SS organization headed by Adolf Eichmann and entrusted with the liquidation of the Jews. Many members of Amt 4B were quite candid in private in admitting that the strategic reason for the Third Reich's scapegoating of the Jews was to give the German people an external enemy, albeit an external enemy within their own borders, to blame their problems on, to blame their loss, their military defeat in World War I, to blame the tremendous social dislocation in Germany because of the economic crises, the inflation, and the murderous inflation and the Great Depression. They wanted to be able to blame their problems on someone else. This psychosocial need was recognized by the Third Reich and turned into a very practical, albeit brutal, social policy. Eichmann himself was very candid about the fact that the Jews were not responsible for Germany's problems, but that it was convenient and necessary to have a scapegoat. It is my fear that perhaps black people and or other minorities in this country may wind up serving a similar function if the national security establishment, that is to say the military and the intelligence services, are sufficiently worried about, say, the possibility of a general insurrection or profound social change in this country as a result of a reaction to a depression. I don't think it can be ruled out, given the historical record, that we might see something of this kind in this country, of that kind in this country. Again, jumping back overseas to West Berlin, the relative success of the Republican Party and the relative success, at least for a period of time, of people like Jean-Marie Le Pen in France, who is running a similar proto-fascistic, or really fascistic, xenophobic platform. He's been espousing a similar platform in France. In the event of an economic collapse, and if one comes, it will be a worldwide collapse, given the internationalization of the world economy and the internationalization of capital in particular, an economic collapse will affect everyone. And again, the growing popularity of parties like the Republican Party, headed up by people like Franz Schoenhuber, and the success in the United States of people like David Duke, not only a former Ku Klux Klansman and associate of George Lincoln Rockwell and his American Nazi Party, but perhaps more ominously, in all probability, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 13, and in turn, in Radio Free America 13, we borrowed from the book The Klan by Patsy Sims. In that book, Patsy Sims talks about David Duke as a probable CIA agent and his CIA role or intelligence role, which is almost certain according to the information Sims presents, is something to think about as we evaluate his role as a white supremacist leader. Again, there are some indications, as I talked about last week, that elements of the national security establishment may be working on just such a contingency plan. I know that's going to sound wild to people, that's going to sound crazy, but people should not lose sight of the fact that many of our country's top industrialists and financiers were sympathetic to fascism, which they perceived as kind of a worldwide antidote to their perceived threat of world socialism. The advent of the first socialist country, the Soviet Union, in 1917, and in particular the tremendous sympathy given to world socialism in one manifestation or another by the economic dislocations of the Great Depression, which swelled the ranks of leftist parties all over the world because people were out of work, they were hurting, they were starving, and they sought a restructuring of the economic order, or at least many of them did at the time. This panicked many of the world's top industrialists and financiers, who to a considerable extent were able to coordinate, albeit imperfectly, their activities in such a way as to boost the dictatorships of Mussolini and then and later and more importantly Hitler and the Imperial Japanese fascist government and their military empire were deliberately aided by the multinational corporations, mostly through direct funding of certain parties, but more importantly, through direct funding of fascist parties around the world and fascist organizations, but even more significantly through a series of cartel arrangements which built up the military capabilities of, in turn, or countries like Italy, like Nazi Germany, the Spanish Falange headed up by Franco, the Japanese. They were the beneficiaries of cartel agreements which gave them patent technology, raw materials, and things of that kind, while restricting the same in their enemies and potential victims, and eventual victims, as it turned out. The point being of all of this, that, again, fascism is not something that was an aberration produced by, you know, some funny little guy with a toothbrush mustache. It was a reaction on the part of some of the most powerful elements in our society, corporations like General Motors, Ford Motor Company, Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon, Standard Oil of New York, Mobil, the Texaco Oil Corporation, AT&T, General Electric, companies of this kind were very active on behalf of the Third Reich. And it's to be noted that these companies obviously bear a strong influence in contemporary society. When we see things like the Gehlen Organization, the Nazi spy outfit from the Eastern Front that was brought into this country and played a prominent role in the post-war development of the U.S. national security establishment, as we looked at, in our first three Radio Free America shows primarily, we then came back to it in numbers 14, 15, number 22, and later programs. It should not surprise us when we see the Gehlen Organization being brought into this country. As we looked at in Radio Free America program number 2, many key Third Reich personnel were installed into the supposedly denazified West German government at the end of World War II. Although the conventional wisdom has it that West Germany was denazified after the war, in fact, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 2, that was not the case. So, again, as we look at Germany, we should understand there, too, that Nazism there was not an aberration. The second largest communist party in the world outside of the Soviet Union at the end of World War I was the German Communist Party. There was an abortive socialist-slash-Marxist revolution in Germany, in fact, several of them, in the 1920s. This panicked the top industrialists and financiers in Germany who actively financed far-right-wing paramilitary groups, including the Nazi Party. In its inception, a front for German military intelligence. Adolf Hitler got his start in government life as an undercover informant for the political department of the Reichswehr, the German army of the Weimar Republic, under General von Lossow. The German Nazi Party, in its inception, was basically a front for Reichswehr intelligence, again, from the political department of von Lossow. Hitler and many of the other early members of the German Nazi Party were infiltrated into a defunct political party, the German Socialist Workers' Party. They then changed it to the German National Socialist Workers' Party and used that organization as a front for fomenting political reaction in Germany, and specifically introducing the German army into civilian society in Weimar Germany as a vehicle for fomenting reaction, and that they did. Again, many of the scenarios that I outline here obviously are a contingency situations. They are speculative in nature. My fear is, given the lessons of history, that in the event, as I said, of a depression, many of the developments that we're looking at moving in the direction of fascism will accelerate. The pace will accelerate, and I'm afraid we may very well see the things that I'm worried about here. But I want to underscore for people that I'm talking about, that many of the things I'm talking about are things that I think might very well happen in the event of an economic collapse, which in light of the really intimidating arithmetic on this country's various kinds of debt, certainly can't be ruled out, let's put it that way. Again, I hope it doesn't happen. We're all going to suffer if it does, but I think it's something that we have to think about. And beyond that, I think we have to think about historical precedent and what has happened in the past when there has been economic collapse. So again, I think, when we see people like Edward Patrick Purdy, who has some as yet apparently, he has some as yet unexplored connections to the Aryan Nations, according to information we looked at, and when we see him going off the deep end, whether he was naturally about to flip out or whether, as I suspect, he had been subjected to mind control and behavior modification techniques and then sent out to basically become another version, another American version of Fritz Haarmann, the Hanover police agent provocateur who, on behalf of Gustav Noske, one of the people who was involved with the Freikorps, the paramilitary units that served the Nazi Party and in the forces of reaction so effectively, Gustav Noske put Fritz Haarmann to work as an informer, a detective, and apparently an agent provocateur, in which capacity he chopped up, he murdered a bunch of young boys and young men and butchered their corpses and sold their flesh as horse meat. This case sensationalized and polarized the political and social climate in Germany. And again, it's when you see Edward Patrick Purdy suddenly flipping out and stalking off in his camis with his assault rifle and blazing away at a bunch of Asian children, and you see in the post-mortems of his action how he talks about how Asians are taking jobs away from Americans and competing for with Americans for jobs over here. I think the larger significance of the Edward Patrick Purdy situation is not to be overlooked. Whether or not he's some kind of an agent provocateur, and as I indicated in my discussion about Purdy, the Aryan Nations connections as yet unexplored or unexplained, the way Purdy was able to travel all around the country with seemingly no money or very little money, and the fact that he was able to purchase several hundred dollars worth of weapons, again, with very little apparent financial means, raise questions in my mind. I think there may very well be more to this case than we've been told. But even if we just take it at face value, if this is a guy who's down on his luck and isn't doing too good and is just sort of a marginal individual, at what point do the strains being produced by America's changed position in the world send somebody like that off the deep end? Because I think for every Edward Patrick Purdy, whether real or now or artificial screwball, for every person like that, I think there are a lot of people who are just on this side of going off the deep end, who, although they themselves would not stalk out into a Stockton schoolyard to shoot a bunch of Asian children, might very well be persuaded to, say, vote for a politician like David Duke, who would vote to limit the black birth rate, as we looked at last week, or vote to limit Asian immigration. I think there are a lot more people who could be sympathetic to someone else, perhaps, holding a gun on Asian school children, while they they look elsewhere. It's happened in the past, and I think the significance of the gains of the Republican Party in West Berlin are not to be overlooked. Again, I think it's significant as a portent, and I think there are some important lessons to be drawn and some things to be thought about for the future here in the United States. Again, a lesson from the past, a warning for the future. As I like to say, learn or burn, read or bleed. Scary little article in the Los Angeles Times of Saturday, February 4th of 1989. An article we've seen a lot of in the past. This is by John, an article that, of a type of which we've seen a lot in the past. This is an article by John Kendall of the Los Angeles Times, headlined NAACP Asks U.S. to Probe Alleged KKK Influence at L.A. Central Jail. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People called Friday for a federal investigation into reports of racial tension at the Los Angeles County Central Jail, where two crosses allegedly were burned by white deputies in quarters housing black gang members. James Martin, director of the NAACP's Western Region, said his organization has been told by inmates and unnamed deputies that some of the white jailers belong to the Ku Klux Klan, the white supremacy organization that has made burning crosses a symbol of racial hatred. Beyond the allegation, Martin said there is no solid evidence, unquote, any jail deputies are KKK members. Nonetheless, he told a press conference that the NAACP is deeply concerned that the KKK influence continues to exist in the Los Angeles County Jail. The Los Angeles NAACP has contacted the U.S. Attorney General with a request that they look into the situation. We've looked at a number of articles talking about ultra-right-wing and paramilitary recruiting in various police departments. A chilling article was sent to us by a listener which detailed the apparently quite successful efforts of an Aryan Nations affiliate, Aryan Nations associate, to indoctrinate the Ogden Police Department in Aryan Nations philosophy. And apparently, at least from what we could see in this particular article, they didn't need a whole lot of indoctrination. It was a pretty scary article to contemplate. This is nothing new. We've taken a look in Radio Free America 13 in particular at Ku Klux Klan and Nazi Party influence within police departments and the National Security Establishment, the military and the intelligence services. One of the things that's alarming to me are some of the similarities, superficial perhaps, between the participation of people like Bill Wilkinson, an FBI informant, David Duke, a probable CIA agent, and other Ku Klux Klan and Nazi Party members. Roy Frankhauser has apparently worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, a fellow we're going to talk about in a second. The similarity between these Klan and Nazi leaders who are government agents and the situation of Hitler and the early German Nazi Party was one that we discussed in Radio Free America 13. And my fear about the consequences of Aryan Nations and Klan recruiting in police departments is that given the support of elements of the national security establishment in a time of economic crisis, this could have consequences for large numbers of people that would be similar to what happened to Timmy Lee several years ago in the East Bay. Timmy Lee was a young black and gay man who was quite apparently lynched, probably by Klan or Nazi elements, and yet the official version, even after a police and FBI investigation, was that it was suicide. And that was really a fairly ridiculous conclusion, given the physical evidence to the contrary that came out. We talked about the Timmy Lee situation at great length several years ago. We also came back to it in part of an archive show called Your Hit Parade, which we talked about a number of suspicious deaths, political murders, suspicious deaths, and disappearances of political activists here in the Bay Area. We're going to take a look now at Ku Klux Klan and right-wing recruiting in police departments. We're going to look at specifically some information from the book Power on the Right. Power on the Right is authored by William W. Turner, a former FBI agent turned author and private investigator. Hardcover edition was published by Ramparts Press, and it's copyright 1971. And in a discussion of Roy Frankhauser, not only a Ku Klux Klan leader, but according to an article we looked at in the past, apparently, at least occasionally, a CIA contract agent, according to information that he himself helped to float. And Roy Frankhauser has some interesting views here. We're going to take a look at his views on race, on recruiting, and on the effects of social polarization, affected not only by white racists, but by black nationalists as well. Reading from The Power on the Right by William W. Turner, talking here about Roy Frankhauser, and the Depew here is Robert Depew, head of the Minutemen. Of Frankhauser, Turner writes, short and wiry, with a bristly mustache, Frankhauser has been a staunch Depew loyalist. Quote, Hitler had the Jews, we've got the niggers, unquote. He was quoted in the June 1969 Playboy piece. That's a 1969 Playboy article about Frankhauser and the Klan. We have to put our main stress on the nigger question, of course, because that's what preoccupies the masses. but we're not forgetting the Jew, unquote. Despite his firebrand language, Frankhauser is nobody's fool. Excuse me, that last sentence again. Despite his firebrand language, Frankhauser is nobody's fool. For the first time since Huey Long, he analyzed, the stage is set for the rise of an American brand of fascism. Not that right-wingers can take any credit for it. The race riots have done our work for us. The black nationalists are our biggest recruiting agents. I wish there were 100 Stokely Carmichaels and Rap Browns. After each Watts, each Detroit, we get thousands of new backlash members. And best of all, a big slice of them are disgruntled cops and National Guardsmen. Something to think about. Also, Frankhauser, again, is an individual who has apparently functioned in conjunction with the national security establishment. He most recently turned up as a member of Lyndon LaRouche's organization and helped to put the federal finger on Lyndon LaRouche. He also, it was at his house that a fellow named Daniel Burroughs was, murdered. They said he committed suicide, but again, in Radio Free America number 13, we took a look at the Burroughs death, and Frankhauser speculated that it wasn't really a suicide because, as he said, bad case of suicide, 3 bullets. But that's what they said, suicide. Daniel Burroughs' name and address were in Lee Harvey Oswald's address book at the time of his arrest, as was that of George Lincoln Rockwell, the Führer of the American Nazi Party. This particular brush with history by Roy Frankhauser, Turner writes as follows. Frankhauser was in the news when, on October 31st, 1965, one Daniel Burroughs committed suicide in Frankhauser's Reading home. Brilliant and psychotic, Burroughs had alternately belonged to the American Nazi Party, the National Renaissance Party, the American Racial Fascist Party, and the KKK. He was on the staff of George Lincoln Rockwell's magazine, The Stormtrooper, resigning in 1962 to edit Kill, which was, quote, dedicated to the annihilation of the enemies of the white people, unquote. Interestingly, too, his name and address, as well as Rockwell's, were in the notebook of accused assassin Lee Harvey Oswald. Burroughs allegedly shot himself when the New York Times printed evidence that he was part Jewish. Make of that alleged suicide what you will. Bear in mind, a 3-bullet suicide. Still later, talking about right-wing activist sentiment among local police departments and its political consequences, Bill Turner writes as follows in Power on the Right. Afflicted with high-strung anti-communism, many police have gravitated into the orbit of the John Birch Society and other radical groups. When Louisiana State University political scientist Fred Grupp, G-R-U-P-P, sent out a questionnaire to a random sampling of Birch members, more than 3% of those responding listed their occupation as policemen, a percentage 4 times that of policemen in the national labor force. A Birch Society regional spokesman has placed the membership in the New York force at 500, which tallies with the observation of a reporter at a Birch-sponsored rally in July of 1965 at New York's Town Hall, that a majority of the audience wore patrolmen's benevolent association badges. In 1963, in Philadelphia, it was discovered that 15 officers were Birchers, probably only a fraction of the total, prompting Mayor James H.J. Tate to institute disciplinary proceedings on the grounds that the society's philosophy, quote, is against certain groups in the big cities, unquote. Other incidents involving Birch Society activity have cropped up in Santa Ana, California, Trenton, New Jersey, Independence, Missouri, and Boston. And, of course, many Deep South law enforcement officers are either Klan members or sympathizers. And bear in mind, they're not talking about other groups that they might not report here, such as the Minutemen or the American Nazi Party. In a footnote to that passage here, Turner talks about the history of far-right-wing and fascist recruiting of police departments. Police affiliation with radical right groups is not new. In the 1920s and 1930s, Klan leaders, according to one account, quote, took particular pride in emphasizing the large number of law enforcement officers that had joined their order, unquote. The Chicago Klan included in its program, quote, supporting officials in all phases of law enforcement, unquote, a slogan reminiscent of the current Birch appeal, support your local police. Klan membership lists seized in California indicated that about 10% of the policemen in practically every California city belonged, including the chiefs of the Bakersfield and Los Angeles departments. That last sentence again. Klan membership lists seized in California indicated that about 10% of the policemen in practically every California city belonged, including the chiefs of the Bakersfield and Los Angeles departments. Again, this is in the 30s. The fascistic Christian Front of the 1930s, headed by Father Charles Coughlin, attracted 407 members from the ranks of the New York PD. The Black Legion, another fascist-type organization that flourished The Black Legion, another fascist-type organization that flourished at the time in the industrial Midwest and specialized in terrorism, attracted many policemen, including top officials in Pontiac, Michigan. The Nativist and Anti-Catholic American Protective Association also attracted large numbers of policemen. And again, this is not something that's new, but my fear is that with official sanctioning, which it did not have at that time, at least not past a point, this type of recruiting by Klan and Nazi groups and others of their ilk could have very, very serious consequences. My feeling is it already is having serious consequences. During the phone-in sessions of past broadcasts, the point has been made, and it's a very good point, that there's plenty of endemic racism in police departments. If that racism is encouraged and organized and channeled by the successful introduction of Klan and Nazi cells and other organizations of that type into police departments to a greater extent than they are now, and perhaps with the blessings of elements of officialdom, then I think we're going to see some very, very serious developments, much more serious than the ones we've seen to date. And again, I think the history of Nazi Germany, the history of how the German people were manipulated in such a way as to accept the doctrinaire anti-Semitism of the Third Reich, and there was plenty of anti-Semitism in Germany due to not only religious tradition, but also to the growing influence of Jews in Western Europe, and Germany and Austria in particular, in the late 19th and 20th centuries. Jews were moving into the middle class in unprecedented numbers, and this was resented by a lot of non-Jews in Europe. So there was plenty of native anti-Semitism, which the Nazis then took advantage of and amplified. And I think the situation in this country, when we see people like Roy Frankhauser saying, Hitler had the Jews, we've got the niggers, we have to think about articles like the NAACP's investigation or call for an investigation of KKK influence in the Los Angeles jail. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills. We're now going to take another musical break and come back with some more discussion of Hitler, an intelligence agent, and we're going to talk about Nazi intelligence during this very same period, the 1930s that we were just talking about, and we're going to talk about a couple of interesting links between the past and the present, one of them, possibly, Ronald Reagan. Back in a few. We're now going to continue with an examination of certain things going on in the same time period that we were just looking at, namely the 1930s. And again, the question of fascist promoting and fascist activities behind the scenes here in the United States as well as Latin America will be front and center. Fascinating little article appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, February 3rd of 1989. In the Personals by Leah Garchick, we find the following, Cary Grant's Other Lives. Two new books about the debonair British-born actor Cary Grant claim that Grant was working for British intelligence during World War II. According to Cary Grant, The Lonely Heart by Charles Higham and Roy Mosley, the actor was recruited as part of a major effort to gather information on Nazis in North and South America. He particularly watched the activities of his third wife, Barbara Hutton, and actor Errol Flynn. According to the book, Grant's colleagues in the spy business included Noel Coward, Alexander Korda, Merle Oberon, and Cedric Hardwick. Maureen Donaldson, author of An Affair to Remember, unquote, says that she had an affair with Grant in 1975 and 77, and that the actress model Vicky Morgan, who later was murdered, had an affair with him in 1973 and 74, at the same time as she was having an affair with Alfred Bloomingdale. Well, there are a number of things that are interesting here. We're going to talk about Ronald Reagan and Errol Flynn, how each of them worked for intelligence agencies or police agencies in an undercover capacity. Errol Flynn as a very key intelligence agent for the Third Reich, Ronald Reagan as an informer for the FBI. We're also going to speculate about, we in this case, as former co-host Nip Tuck, who you will hear presently in a tape segment from One Step Beyond from September 8th of 1985. You will hear both Nip and myself. And we're going to be talking about Errol Flynn. We're going to be talking about Ronald Reagan and the possibility, which was focused on quite a bit by Mae Brussel in her work, the late Mae Brussel being the greatest researcher in this particular field. Mae did a lot of rumination in her tapes about just how deeply the association between Errol Flynn and Ronald Reagan went. Recall that there are a lot of Nazi connections to Ronald Reagan's administration. Helena von Damm, who helped pick his cabinet appointments, a woman with an as-yet undetermined relationship to Otto von Bolschwing, the head of Galen's North American operation, according to one source, and certainly a very important Galen operative and SS man before that. There are a lot of other Nazi connections to the Reagan administration. One of the questions that we have entertained on this broadcast and that Mae entertained for a long time was just how far back some of those connections go. And one of the unanswered questions about Ronald Reagan's background is whether or not he may have served as part of Errol Flynn's spy ring. Something that's interesting, too, is that there's an allegation here that Cary Grant had an affair with Vicki Morgan at the same time as she was having an affair with Alfred Bloomingdale. Alfred Bloomingdale was a member of Reagan's kitchen cabinet, a longtime associate. His wife, Betsy Bloomingdale, was very close to Nancy Reagan. In addition, Alfred Bloomingdale was a member of Reagan's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. And there is an as-yet unsolved level, of the Vicki Morgan case. It was maintained by many that at the time of her death, she was writing a book, which has since been published, which spilled a lot of dirt, so to speak, on various people in the Reagan administration. Beyond that, there's the whole question of Showbiz Pizza, a pizza operation which went precipitously out of business in the early summer of 1982. The collapse of this business helped to, precipitate the growing feud, the growing rift between Vicki Morgan and former lover Alfred Bloomingdale. Bloomingdale had had her on a very handsome monthly fee. He was paying her very handsomely for her services, so to speak. And all of a sudden, the money got cut off because Showbiz Pizza, her little piece of the action, so to speak, suddenly went out of business. Bloomingdale was paying her through this investment in the business Showbiz Pizza. Mae has speculated in her past discussions of the subject that, in fact, Showbiz Pizza may very well have been connected, part of its funding, to the Banco Ambrosiano, which in turn collapsed in the spring of 1982, or late spring, early summer of 1982, right about the time Roberto Calvi was found hanging in London. And Mae speculated that it was the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano that basically caused the breaking in the funding of Showbiz Pizza. Again, that's speculation on Mae's part, informed speculation, based on her study of the situation. But the whole Bloomingdale-Vicki Morgan situation is murky with various tributaries of intelligence services. Again, Bloomingdale himself, not only a longtime Reagan associate, but also a person who was on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Vicki Morgan supposedly was going to spill the dirt on a lot of Reagan people before her death at the hands of Marvin Pancoast, allegedly. She was beaten to death. Also, Vicki Morgan, it should be noted, was previously associated with Bernard Kornfeld in Investors Overseas Services. Kornfeld himself, of course, one of the players in the whole Robert Vesco IOS situation that was one of the major Watergate-related scandals, political scandals, in the early 1970s. Vesco, an individual with a lot of connections to U.S. intelligence and more connections than a switchboard, as we like to say.